there are clearly people dying on the Palestinian side, of course, also on the Israeli side, and that any civilian death is a horrible tragedy. But if we only focus on what is happening without the why, then we're just dealing with the symptoms and not the source of the problem to prevent the what from happening again.
This is Chapters, a podcast dedicated to exploring our story. Who am I and what am I meant to be doing in this world? Perhaps through listening, understanding, questioning, we better understand our own story.
Hi, Rudy.
Shalom.
So Rudy Ruckman is an Israel activist. You're a reservist paratrooper in the IDF fighting in Gaza for 113 days. Rudy has been active on social media and college campuses, engaging in Israel-Palestine debate in the hope of establishing a secure, peaceful future for both ethnicities on their indigenous land. Rudy has been one of the calmest, clearest, strongest voices in our generation, president and founder of the Student Supporting Israel at Columbia University. He's also the producer of the documentary We Were Never Lost, which features the Igbo tribe in Africa holding on to their Jewish traditions for centuries. This project also landed you in for 20 days in a Nigerian prison cell, which I heard you speak about a few times in Great Neck and around Israel. I believe all in all, you are an educator of our collective Jewish story, and I've had the privilege of sharing your voice, your advocacy, your mission with my students over the years. In the current emotional, passionate conflict that we find ourselves in, you're one of the most important voices, both in redeeming our past as well as constructing some sort of conclusive, peaceful future. I think your voice is so important because it actually has some realistic, conclusive future. It's idealistic, but it doesn't gaslight both parties. Thank you so much for being here. It's a huge honor. I'm so grateful. I know you were in Sydney in the past week, really advocating and helping my community. So that really means a lot to me because it's very hard to feel far and it's very hard to feel alone. So thank you for everything you do for our Jewish community.
Of course, there's lots more to do.
Yes. Okay. So before we start, I've heard a lot of your interviews and a lot of your conversations, and you say that your activism really stemmed from the question you had as a child, which was, who am I and where am I really from? And I think that's the question we've been asking ourselves all the past 5 months. Who am I? Where am I from? Because everyone is really asking us to validate our question and validate where we come from and what's our story. So if it's possible to take us back a little bit of your childhood, how you grew up, and how that question really impacted your advocacy today.
Of course, I think it's a question that a lot of Jews can relate, especially if they had an experience in the diaspora. All of my grandparents were born in different countries. On my mom's side, they were born in Morocco and Algeria. In 1948, there was a massacre of the Jewish community in Oujda, leading to my family eventually fleeing due to their families having been killed. On my father's side of the family, they were born in Poland and Belgium, and also escaped the Holocaust and fled from the places. So growing up, I found it strange to identify as Moroccan or Algerian or Polish or from Belgium, because in Morocco, we were not Moroccan. In Algeria, we were not from Algeria. In Poland, we were not Polish. And same thing for Jews in Ethiopia. They weren't Ethiopian. Same thing for Jews in Russia. They were not Russian. It was an experience that we had that is also important because it played to the development of certain traits that we took on. But it's not the origins of where we come from, nor where we belong. At the age of 3, my family moved to Israel, and then at 5, we moved to Miami. And moving specifically to Miami played a big role in my childhood because no one really identifies as being from America in Miami. You're Argentinian, Venezuelan, Colombian, Haitian, Jamaican, Cuban, Puerto Rican, Dominican. And so growing up, I was always labeled as having to be from somewhere else. On top of that, I didn't have a U.S. passport, and I wasn't born in the U.S., so I had to be from somewhere else. And since I was born in France, and when my parents would come pick me up, they had a thick French accent, I was the French kid. And whenever I'd visit my family in France, I was the American cousin. And so I realized that apparently who I am and where I'm from depends on who's asking me the question or where the question is being asked. And that wasn't a real answer for me. I wanted an answer that I connected with, not based on just the fact that I was born in France and lived there till the age of 3. That didn't really connect me. My parents were first generation born there. That's not really where I'm from. And something happened to me as a child, as a 7-year-old, where I went through my first anti-Semitic experience. And to make a story short, my mom and I were kicked off physically from a bus in London for being Jewish. The bus driver had noticed my mom's shirt with Hebrew, found out we were Jews, and physically threw my mom off the bus. And that moment shaped my whole perception of who I was, because I realized it didn't matter where I was born, grew up, lived in, traveled to, reside in, what passport I have, where my parents or grandparents were born, what I believe in or don't believe in, if I'm religious or not religious, practicing or not practicing. What mattered was that I was a Jew. And so naturally I asked myself deeper questions. What does that even mean to be a Jew in the first place? Now, we tend to externalize or to express to the world that Judaism is our religion. What we mean by that in the Jewish world is that this is our identity, our culture, our values, our spirituality, our purpose, our connection to a higher power, our connection to a land, our traditions, our holidays. We when we talk about Judaism as a religion, we mean all that. But the word religion doesn't mean that. The word religion means a belief system in a God, deity, book, or prophet. So if one does not believe in the God, deity, book, or prophet, they're not a part of religion. Hence, in every single example of religions, Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, for example, if one doesn't believe in the deity, in Jesus or Muhammad as a prophet, or in the Quran as a book, or in Buddha as a deity, they're not a part of that religion. So religion is really a wandering ideology that one is a part of if in the moment they believe in it or not, that crosses over borders and nations. And Judaism isn't a wandering ideology that crossed onto nations. It is a physical ancient civilization, native and indigenous to the land of Israel / Judea, that were physically displaced, although we've always maintained a constant presence in the land with Jews staying there. And during our displacement, we sort of created a portable suitcase to pack up our identity, to preserve it, ledor vedor, generation to generation, with the aspiration of Shana Haba b'Yerushalayim, and to revive who we are. So I realized that Judaism is not my religion. Yes, there's a spirituality that's a foundational part of Judaism, just like other indigenous peoples. I don't know one indigenous population that doesn't have spirituality at its core, yet none of them say that they have a religion. So it's not because I'm saying we don't have a religion that I'm trying to remove this spiritual element. I'm just trying to clarify that who we are is a people with a spirituality and not a religion for different groups of peoples, like what religions are. And so I realized, okay, we're a nation. And then I'm asking myself, okay, so, but why am I called a Jew? Because in the Torah, it never says the word Jew. I come from Shevet Levi, the tribe of Levi, from both sides of my family. Jew comes from the word Judah, which is one tribe out of 12, which is I'm not a part of. Why am I called a Jew? And learning Jewish history, you realize that we were one nation with 12 tribes. That nation split into two kingdoms. And the kingdom that some of the families of the members of Israel ended up on was Judea. And that was the last remaining kingdom of today's Jews from Ashkenazi, Sfaradi, and Mizrahi descend from that kingdom of Judea. And because we came from Judea, we now are called Jews, even though not necessarily all of us are from the tribe of Judah. And so I'm telling myself, okay, if the only reason I'm called the Jews because the name of the land then was called Judea, if the name of the land today is called Israel, which is actually the proper name of our entire nation and the land, that makes me Israeli. And from that moment on, whenever someone would ask me, where am I from? I'd say, I'm from Israel. You didn't ask me where I was born. You didn't ask me where I grew up. Different answer. You didn't ask me what passports I have. Different answer. You didn't ask me, where I want to live. You didn't ask me where my parents were born or my grandparents were born. All different answers. You ask me, where am I from? And when someone is asking where you're from, let's say you get into a taxi and the taxi driver is like, hey, where are you from? He's or she is trying to figure out what land and culture do I place you next to? And if as Jews, we answer to the question, where are we from? And we say, we're from Germany, we're from France, we're from Morocco, we're from Australia, we're from America, we're from Canada, then what the world is really hearing is like, oh, that's the people in the land we should connect you to. And so why do we expect others to think that Israel is the home of the Jewish people if we ourselves don't express that when we're asked the question, who are we and where we're from?
It's ironic because this is the time in history where it's the scariest to tell someone. Every time you ask, tell someone you're from Israel, it evokes 100 questions and evokes a lot of antagonism. How do you think as Jewish people in this time period that we're in, how do we face those challenges? How do we answer those questions? How do we remain calm and collected during this time period?
Well, first of all, I'd say I think the only thing Jews should be afraid of is Jews being afraid. Because what happens when we put our heads down and we refuse to deal with our situation, when we divide and when we assimilate, is the worst chapters of Jewish history. Now, it didn't happen overnight that today people are conditioned and hear Israel and think negative things. This has taken decades to get to where it's at now. And the response to the situation has always been to ignore it, to put our heads down, to say, oh, well, you go to a college campus and if a professor says something against Israel, well, parents tell their children, just let the professor say what they got to say, get the good grade, you'll get a good job, you'll get money, and then we'll donate to AIPAC or to the government, and that's how we succeed. And that's generationally throughout history how we've failed. And so the reason we're in this situation is because we've been afraid to stand up for ourselves. And I think every single time there's an opportunity to bring light to darkness in whatever way, but especially when it comes to showing who we are as a people, it's something that we must do. I also have been through, we could say, many dangerous situations in life. So it's fair to say that I have experience with those kind of situations. And in all the situations that I've been, whenever you are strong and you know who you are, it's like you're plugging in an algorithm or a formula that diffuses the anti-Semite. They don't know what to do with strong Jews. So I would say that when you're strong, you will always be able to overcome when you're proud of who you are, and take the opportunity as the person you're engaging. It might be the first time in their life that they meet a Jew. It might be the last time in their life they meet a Jew. So you should actually look at that situation not as a stressful moment or as something that must trigger you emotionally, but as a bracha, an opportunity, a blessing that Hashem, God, has put you through this moment in order to correct that situation and to teach the person that you're speaking to that Jews are good people, and that Jews are strong people, that we have courage, that we're not afraid, and to not necessarily prove them wrong in their maybe attempts to trying to be pro-Palestinian, but to show them that you don't have to be against the Jews and against our right to exist to be pro the Palestinians.
Wow. Okay, so I think in my bio, when I was researching about you, the one thing that really has become part of your identity in the past 152 days is that you're a reservist in Gaza for 113 days. Now, all over the world, I sat in a hospital with my grandfather for a month, and on the news every single day, there are images of Palestinian children dying, portraying Israeli soldiers as Nazis. And I think your voice right now, actually telling everyone the truth, what you saw and what you've experienced, has been the most beneficial thing, that us as Jewish people can feel confident in our story, but also to actually go out there and actually have answers. So I'd like to go back to the 7th of October, a little bit about what that day was like for you and how it sort of unraveled the next 113 days later.
So when I graduated high school at 17, I went straight to Israel and joined the army, served as a paratrooper. Specifically, my job in the paratroopers was to be a sniper, which I still serve as a sniper today. In Israel, once you finish the army, you're still a reservist till age 40 or even mid 40, unless you have physical health issues or mental health issues, or there's other circumstances that cause you to leave. So I'm in my 30s and I'm still in reserves. Every year since getting out, several times a year, we go in for trainings to prepare for a day like this, that in the case we get attacked and we're outnumbered, Israel can call up its reservist force. So October 7th, I was in Caesarea, actually. My grandparents have a family home over there. My cousin was supposed to get married a few days later on a Thursday of the next week. And so all of us were gathered for the Shabbat dinner before the wedding. It was Sukkot, it was Shabbat, it was about to be Simchat Torah. I was planning to go with my grandfather that morning to go to synagogue, which he had invited everyone for a kiddush. And you know, it's a joyous time that I'm with my family that I don't get to see often because most of them live in France. And I wake up in the morning to my mom knocking on the door in tears, showing me videos of things that had just been released and no one really knew at that time, like what was going on. This was happening live. And I saw things that were very traumatic of what the Jewish people faced. Not everything right away, but just of the few videos from the beginning, I knew that this was different than other terror attacks and something was going to happen. By 9:30, I got a message from my commander saying that our unit were being jumped back to war and that we had to show up to base. So I drove from Caesarea to Jerusalem, which is where I live, picked up my army bags, drove from Jerusalem to the base, got there around, let's say, 3 p.m., signed on a gun, signed on equipment that I needed, and by 4 p.m., we were already in cars, in jeeps, driving down south. They didn't tell us where we would go. You know, usually you would think reservists that have been out of the army for years, me over a decade, that we would maybe switch out the current soldiers that are guarding on the border so that they can go in because they're active soldiers. But no, they drove us down to the south. I remember going past the sort of a checkpoint that the police had formed and going past them. And as we're driving past, the police officers were like clapping for us, knowing that we're going to go into combat. And we're going down and down, and I start seeing war zone. I start seeing cars flipped over, burned, bodies all over, people blown up, people burned to black crisp, and just smoke coming out of them still. This was like still fresh. Injured people, terrorists with guns on the side that had been killed, and civilians. And we're driving, and then all of a sudden we turn left, and I see the sign that says Kfar Aza. Now, I didn't particularly know about Kfar Aza before the war, and I didn't know that this was one of the hardest hit communities, and none of us knew what to expect. We get to right in front of Kfar Aza. There's a little booth that is a gate to get in. We're maybe like 100 to 200 meters away from that entrance, and I see a tank going in. And then I see two soldiers from special forces that had gone in quickly and out carrying two babies that apparently their parents had been killed, and they were crying, and they heard the cries and they saved those two children. And then I look to my left and I see 9 or 10 bodies with a huge tarp over, but I notice that these are soldiers because they all had IDF boots. And, you know, these images are just coming to you and you still don't really know what you're about to face. And they told us that we would need to wait about 10 minutes before going in. So there was a gas station right outside of Plaza. There's a gas station to the right if you're facing the entrance. And so we went into the gas station. The police were there and they said, take whatever you want. My idea was to take a few water bottles to pay for them and said, take whatever you want. Going to the section of the water bottles, there was blood all over. Even on the floor, you can see that bodies had been dragged with the blood stains and the marks that were there. There was a woman that was crying hysterically. She must have witnessed horrible things. And from there, I go back out, I give water to my unit, and this is where we start heading in. And for 2 days, we were in Kfar Aza fighting Hamas, clearing Hamas from the area, taking back the land of the people of Israel, and making sure that no more Hamas terrorists were entering into the land of Israel because the borders weren't secure, and saving the civilians that were still there afraid. And once we cleared out Hamas, that's when Zaka, the unit that retrieves bodies, came. And you could imagine after 2.5-3 days of being in the sun, that the bodies, some of them were swollen, some of them were smelling really bad, and they came, and just for the entire day on the third day, it's just body after body after body being taken, bag after bag. You know, there was the Zaka cars that are like ambulances, and on the back of an ambulance you have a window where you can see within it, and you can see how many bodies were stacked up to the top. And one of the, there's gruesome scenes that I'm not going to necessarily repeat all of them, but just something that I can share that I think it's very important for people to hear because a lot of people are trying to deny it. I remember one of the Zaka soldiers coming out of a house that was near us and having a small bag, and I realized that this was an infant, and there was still a knife sticking out of the bag. And so it wasn't just that they killed people, it was that they wanted people to suffer. They wanted people to see their children being killed in front of them, their mothers being raped in front of them, you know, the fathers being burned in front of them. They wanted to cause as much pain and suffering as they could. And, you know, it came out after with many interviews of people that they've caught that Hamas saw it as the Jewish people are so divided right now, this is our moment to attack. And I think that's something we need to talk about, because there's this perception that Israel has such a great military and we have such great technology and the best intelligence of the world. And so there's this like sort of chip on our shoulders that we're protected no matter what. And we're protected because Hashem protects us, not because we're so good. I mean, we are good, but we're protected because Hashem has a protective shield over us. And throughout Jewish history, 4,000 years of history, to the person that's religious or not, you can't deny history. Whenever Am Yisrael is together, empowered and fulfilling the purpose that we're here for, we overcome the greatest challenges and miracles happen. And the greatest nations that have tried to kill us, we overcome them. Whenever Am Yisrael is divided, assimilating and going against what we're here, those are the chapters that are worst in Jewish history. And what happened right before October 7th is the country being completely divided. And I think we hit a new low on Yom Kippur when Jews were going to pray, and obviously there's so many people come on Yom Kippur, so sometimes they need to do services outside because there's not enough room to fit everyone else, and you had individuals going and disrupting Yom Kippur services. I think that the protective spiritual metaphysical shield that we had was lifted, and that Hamas knows that, and that's why they chose to attack. I mean, even in the Torah, there are nations that, you know, try to bring the Jews spiritually down in order for them to attack us in those moments, and that's what happened. We were divided, and every time in history when we're divided, these things happen, which is why we need to know to never be divided. Even if we have differences, these are things to bring together. Following October 7th and fighting in Kfar Aza, our unit was brought to the north. There were a lot of threats of potentially Hezbollah joining the war. And so we were stationed in the north, and several times there was like a, we're going in and then pulled out. So we didn't know exactly if we would go in, when it would happen. And after Lebanon was realized no longer to be a threat, at least for now, we were brought to the south on the border of Gaza. And the stages of entering Gaza was first to the north on the side of the ocean and then to the south. And so our unit was the first unit to get into Gaza in the operation going into the south, specifically into Khan Yunis, the front of the front of the front lines. There was nobody there before us. And for 2 months, we fought Hamas and Khan Yunis, and then were released about a month ago. And Baruch Hashem, I'm back to my life to be able to spread light in my own way.
Whoa, okay. What was that day like in Kfar Aza? What were you thinking? Were you angry? Did it feel like we were back in 1945? Did it feel like the Holocaust? Were you upset? Were you fearful? Were there emotions?
There were a lot of emotions. It's not something anyone could really be prepared for, seeing that amount of savagery, of bodies butchered, of dead people, and it's your own people. Like, nobody could ever be prepared for seeing that. But what's important is contextualizing the situation. I'm not there on a field trip and then being affected from what I see based on just that being there. I'm there to make sure that this doesn't continue. And so because I know that I'm there to protect life and to stop deaths and to minimize pain from happening, all that I'm seeing is contextualized by I have a bigger purpose and I'm there for a larger reason, and that's what I need to focus on. And I think when you look at a trauma, there are two people that can go through the same situation and one person be traumatized and the other not, right? You can have a car accident and someone in the car doesn't want to get in cars anymore after going through that experience, and another person is fine and understands, okay, there was just a drunk driver and it happens. So I think when it comes to this trauma, there are soldiers that can come out of it and, you know, be broken, be hurt, and there's soldiers that can be completely fine. It's not because you go through a trauma that you're going to have PTSD. It's a lot about how you understand the situation in the moment. And I think PTSD comes a lot about the feelings you had. If you're in shock, if you're broken, if you're hurt, if you're in pain, if you're afraid, in that moment when you're going to remember that experience, you're going to remember that those feelings. You're going to remember pain. You're going to remember fear. You're going to remember hurt. Because when I was there, all I could think about is save Jews. I understand where I'm at. Save innocent civilians, even not Jews, that were killed and that were targeted. Protect life. When I look back at that moment, I'm proud of myself to have been there, and I will do it all over again if I need to stand up for justice wherever it is and wherever that would take me.
Wow. And what was Gaza like? Can you give us like some sort of first, you're an eyewitness, right? And we are seeing a lot of footage coming out of Gaza. So if it's possible to contextualize, like, what does it look like? What did your missions look like? Were you engaging with civilians as much as you can say? But do you ever have like moments of like, what's it called? Like a moral...
Like a dilemma?
Yeah, a moral dilemma. Were there times where you question why you were there? Were there times that were difficult?
So it definitely was not an easy experience. I want to first say that I can't speak on the experiences of others. I can only speak on what I saw, and I saw plenty to be able to speak about it. And so going in, there were no civilians in Khan Yunis. The IDF had already dropped leaflets, evacuated people 2 days before. I remember seeing the leaflets on the floor already kind of damaged from the rain, showing that they had already been there for a few days. And so civilians were completely supposed to be cleared out. I also want to say that there are clearly people dying on the Palestinian side, of course, also on the Israeli side, and that any civilian death is a horrible tragedy. But if we only focus on what is happening without the why, then we're just dealing with the symptoms and not the source of the problem to prevent the what from happening again. Being in Gaza, Hamas was all over. They had set booby traps, snipers in buildings, tunnels, in every location that we went, prepared for an entrance of Israel. They knew that this is what's going to happen, and they were there to fight. Unfortunately, we did see a lot of times that Hamas was going from one tunnel to the next or trying to get supplies, that they would go out and they would take children with them, two, three, sometimes four children surrounding them, knowing that IDF soldiers were not allowed to kill children or would do everything to avoid that. And if they were in a situation where they had no other choice because this person is about to go and detonate a bomb and go and kill Israelis, and so they warn, and they warn, and they have no other choice but to fire at this person that's firing at Israel, that at worst case scenario for them, civilians would die, and then they would be able to use those deaths to project to the world, look at how bad Israel is. And you know, if a person pushes another person into a fire, the cause of death in the coroner's office is fire, but the murderer is the person who pushed them. So when you're in an impossible situation where either you shoot and your family is alive, or and then people that are innocent may be killed, but you didn't create that scenario, or you do nothing and your family is killed, either option you take is bad. So who set up that situation? Who set up that scenario? Who created that reality? That's what I think we need to talk about. And the whole world is showing a lot of videos that happened in Syria, happened in other places that have nothing to do with the situation. So there's a lot of fake news happening there. And I think that the world that is so obsessed with this conflict, you know, I ask them because I am someone that's pro-Palestinian, and I've been for many years bringing Israelis and Palestinians together, correcting the perception Israelis have towards Palestinians, humanizing them, making their narrative, like talking about the Nakba or Palestinian identity or their aspirations or right of return and the things that they need or want, normalized within Israeli societies, and talking about how Israel as a government has the power, thus the responsibility to fix the situation, even though it didn't. What I have to say as someone who's been fighting for my cousins is this whole world that is all of a sudden obsessed and removing all the context of what's happening and cherry-picking instances of Palestinian suffering. Where were you when Palestinians were dying by the thousands in the Syrian civil war? Where were you on Black September when Palestinians were being killed in Jordan? Where were you when Palestinians have no freedom of speech under the Palestinian Authority or Hamas and get killed for saying anything else than the norm, which is we want to kill Jews, including some of my friends that have disappeared for going out and have even blurred their faces and changed their voices, and somehow sometimes their information gets leaked and they disappear for a few months, or they go in prison because they did a Zoom call. Like, where were you talking about Palestinian struggles when it comes to things not to do with Israel? That doesn't mean you can't talk about the situation with Israel, but if you only care about Palestinian struggles when it has to do with Israel, then you don't actually care about Palestinians. What you care about is to use their injustices that they face now in order to manipulate their suffering only when it fits your agenda, and use that as ammunition to attack Israel, which only creates more conflict, because there is no reality where Israelis or Palestinians will disappear. So as long as from an outside perspective, you're investing energy in making a zero-sum game of one versus the other, you are part of the problem. You are fuel to the fire of this conflict. So, you know, it wasn't easy being in Gaza, not being able to go to the bathroom, you know, having to use plastic bags, not being able to take off your clothes,
your shoes,
not taking off your shoes for weeks at a time, not taking off your vest with bulletproof plating when you sleep, and sleeping maybe an hour here, 2 hours there, and having to do guard duties, being under fire, losing friends, you know, being smiling with one person one moment, and then the next moment realizing that there's a funeral that you won't be there. It's not easy seeing people dying. It's not easy being in a situation of being pulled out from your life, from everything that you're doing, and all of a sudden thrown into the situation that we don't want to be in. You know, when Israelis say we don't want a ceasefire is because A, Hamas will continue to attack Israel, so there is actually no ceasefire. That doesn't mean we don't want to end to a war or don't want to be at war. None of us want to be at war. And so I didn't see any situation where someone acted immorally. Again, like I said, I can't speak on other experiences. That doesn't mean that you didn't have individual bad players in other scenarios that I didn't witness. But everything that I saw, the IDF told us and Israeli soldiers did in every way limit civilian casualties. And we're not there fighting our Palestinian cousins. We're not there fighting Arabs. We're not there fighting Muslims. We're there fighting Hamas. And Hamas should be taken out. And the people of Gaza and the Jewish people and Israelis should be freed from that mentality. And I think Israel has allowed Hamas to exist for so long, has allowed Hamas to educate an upcoming generation to hate the Jews. And I mean, I have three suitcases of propaganda, of books that kids learned and studied of how the Jews are the source of all problems, Nazi imagery, Mein Kampf translated to Arabic, workbooks of a kid in first grade, second grade, Kita Aleph, Kita Bet, just being taught that, you know, if you want to fight back, you need to look at the Jew as the source of the problem and externalize all your pain on the solution to ending that pain is by killing Jews and destroying Israel. And, you know, although Israel didn't create that, I see it that it failed, because it had a responsibility to protect those Palestinians from being educated in that way, provide them with a better life, fixing their situation. And Israel didn't do that. You know, we talk about Tikkun Olam and Or Lagoyim, to heal the world and empower all nations and to free them and to bring them the light. Well, how about Tikkun Babayit Mabnei Dodim? Well, how about we fix our own home with our own cousins and fix this reality? Again, it doesn't mean we created it, but if we have the ability, it gives us the responsibility to fix it. And so I hope we learn from our lessons that we don't not deal with our problems, because if we don't, the problems will deal with us. And I hope that we will take more of a responsibility to change the reality for Palestinians, given, you know, investing in infrastructure and education and sewage and roads and job opportunities, in normalizing relations and humanizing one another and understanding their identity and aspirations and their suffering and their history and what they want to go to their future. And Israel has the role to do that. I think it has to come from Israel's side.
So 3 points. Firstly, how do you think Israel could do that? Like, practically, how are we going to go in there and try and change their mindset and educate them? Especially, we know, like, when it comes to the Aboriginals in Australia, every time people come from the outside, it's not necessarily, doesn't really go down well. Secondly, what do you think about, like, what Mia Shem said? And do you have, like, a different perspective? Do you think, like, when we say Hamas and Palestinians, are there differences? And three, has your perception actually changed? Obviously, you're pro-Palestinian. You've always, in all your confrontations with people on college campuses, you've always like, I'm pro the Palestinians. I want them to be thriving. Do you think that that has changed since everything that you've witnessed in Kfar Aza?
So in terms of how to build a future, there cannot be a future built if you don't focus on fulfilling the aspirations of both collectives and ending the injustices of both collectives. And I think we don't know what the aspirations of Palestinians are. We tend to superimpose what we want, thinking that that's what they want, and they do that to us. So we don't really know what Palestinians want, and we have 4 options on the table, really. Option number one is one nation is going to kill the other, exterminate the other. I don't see Jews killing all Palestinians or Palestinians killing all Jews, so that's not going to happen. The second option is one nation will displace the other completely. I don't see Israel going to every single house of a Palestinian and kicking them out, or Palestinians going to every single house of Israelis and kicking them out. So these 2 options that are potential scenarios, hypothetically, obviously not going to happen. The next option is to continue the status quo, which is where we're at. People are suffering on both sides. And the fourth, which is the option I invest my energy in, and the only thing that can happen, is to create a reality that fixes the problems both face and fulfills the needs that both have. Now, if we look at the past, let's say 10 years or even more, 18 years that Hamas has been controlling Gaza and educating that population for 18 years now, that they need to see Israel as the source of the problem. Well, let's take an example of Nazi Germany, which not too long ago were our greatest enemies and exterminated 6 million Jews. That same civilization, after they killed 6 million Jews, 10 years later supported the state of Israel. So if with Esav and the extreme of Esav, Amalek, eventually that nation can come back and realize that they not only not need to kill Jews, but also are supporting Jewish empowerment, if we can do that with people that are so different than us, I think definitely between cousins, we can change that reality. And I think it'll be much harder for voices that have the Hamas ideology or the PLO ideology that we just need to kill Jews as a response. It's a lot harder to sell that to the people if the relationship with Israel is one that provides them salvation rather than one that is complicit in their suffering. Right now they experience Israel, and there's checkpoints, there's limitation of movement, there's soldiers controlling them. They experience Israel negatively, let alone the fact that they're told why they suffer is because Israel exists. All they can think, contextualizing the situation, is that we need to get rid of Israel to be able to have a better life. But if Israel is able to provide them with that better life and create something that works, that gives them what they want without taking up or giving up on what we want, then that's the only way to move forward. And I think there's many ways of accomplishing that. I think there's many fears that justly both people have. There's a lot of distrust that both peoples have. But I think fundamentally we need to start having an ideological shift of humanizing both sides, of understanding what we want, and coming up with potential hypothetical solutions based on those needs. And that's something Israel has never tried, and no one really has those conversations. So obviously we're in the same situation, because killing each other and displacing each other is not going to happen. And continuing the status quo is going to only allow happening what has happened. So that's what I think about. We can go more in detail about it practically, of what things could be done with Israel. But I think overall, that's how people should approach the situation. when it comes to my view on Palestinians, yes, I think that most people in Gaza are brainwashed. That doesn't mean all of them want Jews to be killed, but definitely the majority of them are brainwashed in a way or another. I can speak about the very few interactions that I had with civilians while in Khan Yunis. There was a place, let's say there's a line where the IDF is and no Palestinian is behind us. There's a individual, a man in his 40s or 50s, comes in past that line knowing that this is where the IDF is. Now, in our experience, whenever that happens, it's usually Hamas terrorists trying to come in to kill Israelis, which unfortunately has happened several times. And the IDF notices that, goes towards him, doesn't open fire because he doesn't have a weapon, and captures him. They put handcuffs and they blindfold him, they bring him to a safe location, and there's someone who's part of the intelligence there that speaks Arabic and starts questioning him, asking him, like, who is he? Is he part of Hamas? And he says he's not a part of Hamas, but he's a school teacher and he teaches history and Islam. And, you know, for some reason, the intelligence officer, and I filmed this actually, I'm going to post it at some point, he asked him, do you support what happened on October 7th? Do you support the massacre of Israeli civilians? And he looks at him and he says, this is the way of Islam, and I'm proud of that. And so this is the person in charge of their education, right? This is the person that who knows how many young, beautiful souls went through his classroom and were taught that the way of Islam is to kill civilians, and the way for Palestinians is to kill their cousins. And that's where the source of this comes. The outcome, there's a cause and effect. The effect is people being educated and seeing the world in a bad way, and there's no freedom of speech for other opinions. So it's not like you even have competing ideas and there's an opportunity to agree with this or agree with this. This is the only idea being presented. So understanding that, again, Israel didn't create it, but we have a responsibility to fix it. And we have a responsibility to invest in education, to create freedom of speech, to invest in infrastructure, in roads and job opportunities, in sewage systems, in resources and water access, in all sorts of things to make Palestinians' life free in every way. And I think we need to do that not just for humans and not just for our cousins, but even for animals. Like the fact that there's pollution in Israel, the fact that, you know, animals might be suffering when there's environmental issues, that even is something lower level, but that's even something we should be caring about. So definitely human beings, definitely our Palestinian cousins is something that we need to take care of and to fix that situation.
People could argue, why is that our problem? Why do we need to go in and actually improve their lives?
So if a doctor chooses to become a doctor, because no one's forced to be a doctor, right? You grow up and you decide, you know, I'm going to go through medical school. I'm going to go through years of my life to be trained to have the ability to save someone's life. And then you have the skills. And let's say you're in a situation where there's a cardiologist in front of a person that's having a heart attack and he or she has all the tools to save this person's life and everyone's watching. And then this person just watches and does nothing and the guy dies. Like, yeah, he didn't kill him, but how is everyone experiencing that situation? All they can see is how evil this person is for not using his ability. The family member of the person that, let's say, had a heart attack, they're not going to talk about their diet and their exercise routine and why they truly had a heart attack. All they can think about in the funeral is how evil this doctor is that didn't do anything. So the Jewish people were the chosen people. That doesn't mean that Hashem chose us. It means that we chose this mission in the world. And our mission as a nation is to be the world's immune system, because the immune system does the role of the Jewish people within the larger body, which is to heal the world and to empower the other nations. The immune system heals the world and empowers the body and empowers the other organs to fulfill their potential. And when the immune system doesn't work, the body fails. And it's not the immune system that created the diseases, but it failed its responsibility. So we have a responsibility, A, because that's what we chose. We chose to be the doctor. We didn't have to, but we chose to do that. And two, this is our land. This is our family. And we have the power. If Palestinians were in power, I would expect them to use their power to change the situation. We have the power. I'm not sorry for that, but we need to understand what that power comes with. It comes with responsibility, and it's something that I think in many ways we've done good, but in many ways we failed, and it's time to no longer fail.
I think it's so interesting because whenever you talk about, you don't believe in a two-state solution. Is that correct? Okay. So there, firstly, I want to hear why. And also, so your solution is, I've heard you speak a lot, that there's no compromises on both ends. We're both able to live in this land together. I want to hear a little bit about what you think a practical solution is for this conflict, because the reality is, if we don't do something about it, on one hand, we don't want to reward the Palestinians for what they've done by giving them a state. There's a lot of security issues. On the other hand, the reality, the facts are, there's 7 million Jews and 7 million Palestinians living on this land. Like you said, no one's going anywhere. We don't want our children and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren to be continuing fighting in the IDF, putting their lives in peril. This is just it's a cycle that will never end if we don't do something about it. So what is a practical solution that is obviously something that can be implemented that you think we have a responsibility to put into place?
I think it's very interesting how people are still trying to somehow push the two-state solution if the majority of Israelis and the majority of Palestinians don't want that. I'm sure you're familiar with the story, but if not, I'll share it for those listening. There's a great story of King Solomon as not only an amazing king, but as a wise leader who has two women coming to his court claiming to be both the mothers of this child, this baby. And there were no maternity DNA tests to be able to see who is the real mother, so King Solomon has to decide. And he doesn't have an ability to know who the child is. So what he says is, you know what? I'm going to take this baby and I'm going to cut the baby in half, and you're going to get half and you're going to get half. Now, obviously, he wasn't going to do that. It was a test. And one mother says, okay, that's fine. That's fair. At least I get half. Another mother says, it's actually not my baby. It's her baby. Let her take all of it. And that was a sign to show who the real mother is, because the real mother would never cut her baby in half. So if Palestinians connect to this land truly, they'll never be willing to cut it in half. If we connect to this land truly, we'll never be willing to cut it in half. It's our soulmate. It's not something we can cut off from us. It belongs to our ancestors and to our descendants. Now, the land that people are even talking about potentially cutting off in a hypothetical two-state solution is Judea and Samaria. That is the cradle of Jewish civilization. When we look at Jewish history, it's not Tel Aviv and Kfar Saba and Ra'anana and Kesaria and all these newer cities, which are great, you know, in their own way. It's Hebron, it's Shrem, which was recalled Nablus from Neapolis from the Romans. It's Bethlehem, it's Shiloh, it's Yerushalayim. It's all these places that are in the cradle of Jewish civilization. So if we're saying that this is the land that we're from, then how can we give up the most important part of that land, let alone the fact that the security concerns of that area being on a higher plane than the lower area, let alone the fact that we've seen what happens when Hamas or the Palestinian Authority have control over the people and what they want to do. And I think something that a lot of Jews don't understand and are still pushing this ridiculous idea is that you have about 600 to 700,000 Jews living in Judea and Samaria. All of them have guns. The majority of Israel supports them being there. The majority of combat officers in Israel are religious Zionists. If anyone were to ever think that they are going to go into Judea and Samaria and physically remove Jews, you would see a civil war, and one that the side that's trying to remove them would lose. So let's put that to the side, because that's not what Palestinians want. That's not what Israelis want. Now, what do we want for generations? When we get married, the Dovado, and we smash the glass, and that represents the destruction of Jerusalem and the promise that we will one day rebuild our civilization. This is something that's like a fundamental goal of the Jewish people, is to recreate our kingdom. Now, obviously, we've evolved to more of a republic type system where people have a right to vote, you know, which is great, but we have always sought to reestablish our civilization. That is a non-negotiable. Now, Palestinians never had a country, kingdom, civilization. That doesn't mean that they don't have a connection that is deeply rooted to this land, that they will eternally belong to this land, that they deserve the right to live here free from the river to the sea. All that is true, but we need to understand, like, what are the core needs of both peoples? The only ones from the Palestinian side talking about creating a state, which is not a conversation that happened pre-48, only a conversation that happened post, let's say, even 64, right? The only people talking about that is because they're saying it's the only way for us to get what we truly want, which is a life with honor and respect and equal access to movements and from the river to the sea, everywhere that we want to go. If we want to move there, if we want to travel there, we get that, right? The only way to do that is by creating a state. So it's important not to see the current situation that they think that they can get what they want as what they truly want. Also, Palestinians' non-negotiable is the right of return. For all Palestinians to have the ability, whether they're in Jordan, whether in the refugee camps in Syria and Lebanon, whether they're living in the diaspora elsewhere, to have the right of return. Now, as a concept, Palestinians coming in is not something that goes against our values. The reason why Jews experience this idea as negatively is because they experience most Palestinians as against Israel. So you're talking about bringing in a population that would be against your own population, and obviously that creates a lot of triggers and worries. And also, demographically speaking, if you bring in millions of people in a democracy that you would now no longer have a Jewish majority, you would no longer have a Jewish state. So Jews are rejecting of the idea that is non-negotiable for Palestinians, which is right of return, not because we're against the idea of you returning, but because it represents something negative. So when we try to find a solution, we need to understand all this to say, okay, fundamentally, the Jews don't necessarily don't want Palestinians here, right? And fundamentally, the Palestinians have never had an aspiration to create a state. What they want is river to the sea to be free and right of return. And what they want is Jewish state in the sense that they have their civilization rebuilt, others can live as a part of the civilization freely and be respected in this land. So how do we create something that works for both? And there are many ideas on the table. There's federation systems that have been proposed similar to a canton system in Switzerland or an emirate system in the UAE. Or, you know, something that I've been working on for many years is the return of all people connected to this land, not just Palestinians, not just the 15 to 16 million Jews that we are, but also the tribes of Israel, which are in the hundreds of millions out there. And so if we allowed all people to come back that are connected to this land, Palestinians and all of Israel, the majority that we feel threatened by this idea is no longer a threat. And then they can come back and we can come back and be able to establish a reality they all want. Now, of course, there's lots of other things that need to happen. A shift in the education and how we view each other, making Israel an experience for Palestinians that they feel respected, and they can still call it Palestine if they want. Who cares about the name? You know, as long as they respect us calling it Israel, as long as they respect our needs of having economic, political, and military sovereignty over this land. And we need to just set on the table all the needs that we have, like the non-negotiable needs. And when you do that, and I've done this with countless Palestinians, leaders, people who are pro-Hamas and pro-BDS and all the things that we experience as negative, when we set all the needs, they don't actually contradict. What I find fascinating when I speak to Palestinian activists who may originally be pro-Hamas and pro-BDS, and we break down the walls between us, all the emotions, and we get to speaking and understanding that we're cousins and we're allies and our future is linked together. When I speak about a leadership, a civilization, a reality that's like Malak Daoud, Melech David, immediately they turn to saying, that would be fair. Why? Because they experienced Melech Daoud as a just king that cared about everyone, including the non-Jews there, and created the best reality for them. So you tell them Melech David, and immediately there's trust. However, Melech David was a Jewish king in a Jewish civilization. So they're not against the idea of a Jewish king and Jewish civilization. They're against the ways in which they've experienced that Jewish civilization. And I think there's also fascinating ways in which how we perceive populations. You know, Jews usually tend to judge peoples by their majorities. If the majority of a group is this way, then I'm going to treat that person as like afraid, or maybe assume justfully so that that person might be against me. And so most Palestinians that Jews speak to, which unfortunately we don't speak to many, are usually pretty anti-Israel. I mean, you go to college campuses, you know, there's so many chants against Israel. You see the protests, you see the marches, you see stuff on social media, you see individuals being put into TV shows and talk shows. So usually what we hear from the Palestinian side is that they're against us, they're against us, they're against us. You don't see any movements by Jews on university campuses trying to boycott Palestinians just for being Palestinians, on trying to demonize them and to delegitimize their claim to the land and pretend that they're foreigners and to appropriate all the things that the Western world has done to the world, like apartheid, genocide, ethnic cleansing, settlements, and colonization, and then using that and riding on the struggles that other people face in order to then push it onto the Jewish people. They don't see that. The average Jew that you ask them, not to say that there aren't extremists out there, but the average Jew that you ask them, you know, do you hate Palestinians? They'll tell you no. So why is it that the average experience of a Palestinian when they look at the Jews and what they do outwardly is something usually positive? I'm not talking about the idea for politicians and the wars that we're in. I'm talking about the average Jew, the population. And the average experience, at least from what Israelis see, what Jews see, is usually negative towards a Palestinian. How are we still willing to be like, no, there's some good ones and there's ways to move forward? And on the other side, when I meet many Palestinians, like, no, all the Jews are bad. And that's not all. There's many, many Palestinians who don't view it that way, but that's still a reality. And I think we view populations differently. We view them by the sum of how they act and we interact with them. They view us as, your people are in power, I suffer, your people don't. Until your people and your power is used to end my suffering, you guys are all responsible. And whether that's fair or not, it's just the reality. And I think if we understand that this is how they see power, then let's use that power and give them a different relationship to the experience of what it means like for Jews to be back in power in their land.
Well, so you think it's realistic for 5 million Palestinians to return, get a citizenship, Torah Zohot, and we bring all the lost tribes back and there wouldn't be a demography issue?
Well, if there is no issue of numbers of populations and the people coming back aren't inherently against the Jews in Israel, right? We're talking hypothetically. Is there a problem of Palestinians coming back? No. So let's try to give them what they want without taking away from what we want and create that scenario for it to work. It is possible, and it's the only other option, because right of return is not something negotiable. And I'm honest with them. Third Temple is not negotiable. It is a must. It is going to happen in Bezat Hashem in our lifetime. But for us, a third temple doesn't mean that you don't have access to that place as well. In the Torah, the temple is a place of Hashem, of Allah, for all people who submit to this oneness that we're a part of. It's not a place just for Jews. Yes, it's in the capital of the Jewish people, and it's the temple of the Jewish people, but it's open and accessible for all. So me wanting to build a temple doesn't mean excluding you from doing that. And again, I think when we break down what we truly mean by what we want, and we get to the bottom of the things that we're rejecting because of fears, if we can build it and structure it in a way that works for all, which is something that has never tried, we won't get there. And you know, I hear all the time, you're so idealistic, it's a utopian. Well, you know what? Everyone who changed history were idealistic and utopian. And the way they changed history is by not listening to the people that call them idealistic and utopian. And all the people saying that, well, you're just a drone in the matrix, and you could be playing a role to actually bring that reality quicker if you stood up and did something about it.
No, I think firstly, you actually do things to change that. And I think the thing that you do that's really going to change everything is education, because I believe that this entire war is an educational conflict, a conflict of narratives, a conflict of history. If I grew up in Gaza and I went through an UNRWA school, I'd also be a terrorist. You know, if I grew up my whole life hearing that these Jews from Eastern Europe came and took over my land and now I live in this terrible refugee camp in Gaza, and I see pictures of people on the beach in Tel Aviv partying, you know, I would also be a terrorist. And that was my educational system. So I really think that education is the way forward. Also teaching Israelis that all Palestinians aren't bad, which I struggle with myself. I struggle with saying that line. It feels triggery to me, because spending a month in Near Oz, hearing all the catastrophes at this point, it feels like there will never be peace. But I think it's important to recognize that peace can, you believe there can be peace.
I want to share a little Torah with you. You know, there's leaders of generations in our history and written about in the Torah, like Noach, right? He was the leader of his generation. There's Abraham, there's Moses. And why are Abraham and Moses considered to be our people and Noach isn't? And I think if you look at these three leaders of their generations, these greats, these tzaddikim, when Hashem came to them and said, I've given up on these people, I'm going to just wipe them out and start new, Noach said, okay, that's what you want, you know better, I accept that. And the entire generation was wiped out and the world was restarted after the flood. Avraham, Hashem says, we have to destroy Sodom and Amorah. He says, no, I'm going to find some tzaddikim. There's a majority bad, but there's still some good people there. And just for the sake, there's 100, there's 50, there's 10. There's still good people there, and I have to do everything to save the few good, even if there's a few good. Even after the Jews did the golden calf and Hashem wanted to give up, and Moses is like, no, you have to trust them. There's still something there. You have to forgive them. There's still good in there. And I think something that's a huge Jewish value that we need to remember, especially now in this generation, is that we cannot just judge all peoples, even when the majority are bad. We have to understand the context of how they came there to be. No one is born hating someone. You know, these individuals that are taught that the reason why they suffer is because of Israel, we need to free them from that reality. That's what Ola Goy means. It's not being an exemplary nation, it's freeing the world from idolatry, freeing the world from materialism, freeing the world from shekel, from darkness. We need to free them from that. And terrorism is an anti-colonial tool. The Jews used terrorism against the British military when they were here, making them leave because they would have never left otherwise. So terrorism works against colonial powers. The problem is they think that Jews are foreigners, and if they're going to use terrorism, eventually the Jews are just going to leave. That's what the Nakba means, shaking them off. But the problem is when you use anti-colonial tactics on a people that are not colonial and are actually indigenous and are 100 times stronger than you, you're going to lead to the same result if you plug in the same input. And so this is, again, understanding the greater structure of what's happening. You take a step back and you realize what's going on, and then you're saying, okay, well, let's do things in a way that moves us forward, in a way that corrects the traumas, that heals the situation, that builds a foundation that works for both. And we have never tried that. And of all the ideas that I've shared today, there's many more that I have in mind, there's many more that I've heard, but I'm just one individual. You know, there's many great minds of Jews and Palestinians that if we started to think of the situation this way, and different ideas were brought to the table, we could easily be able to fix this.
You think so?
Absolutely.
So you mentioned the British powers, and I think I just want to touch upon it. You speak about America being, people in Israel, they love to say Israel's a 51st state. We're very reliant on money, military power coming from the Americans, and I think it's been like this for generations. We were relying on the British. How do you think Israel can step forward as an independent country and make decisions for ourselves?
So let's break down the British, let's break down the Americans. Before 1948, the people who ruled this land, the colonizers, the occupiers, the settlers, the foreigners, the actual white supremacists that wanted to just dictate the world because they thought that they were superior than others, many of them because of their skin color, or their culture, or their race, when they came here and came to other lands, the way that they would maintain control is by dividing local peoples and having them fight each other. We can see that in India, Pakistan, which used to be one land, one country, one people. We can see that in Afghanistan with the tribal divisions. We can see that in Nigeria, which is a made-up country that united three different local ethnic groups and regions, the Yoruba, the Hausa Fulani, and the Igbos, and created this problem of the Igbos were the economic class, but the Hausa Fulani had the population, so they would have the political power, and naturally you create this tension. And they did that between the Israelis and the Palestinians. So how did the British convince the Israelis, the Jews, that the Palestinians and the rest of the Arab world were their enemies? Well, they appointed a person named Haji Amin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, which was not appointed by the Palestinians, was appointed by the British. Really? And this individual met several times with Hitler, you know, had a very clear stated goal over and over and over again that he wanted to kill all Jews and kill all Jews in this land, and told Hitler, when you're done with the Jews in Europe, come and finish them here. This is that individual. That is the person that the British chose to appoint as the leader of the Palestinians. So what do you think Jews are hearing when they see your leader saying that you want to kill us all? They experience that this is what you want and start experiencing the Arab world and Palestinians as their enemy. Now, if you ask most Palestinians or Arabs that are against Israel and you ask them, why are you against Israel? They'll usually say, well, it's an extension of European colonialism. And you ask them why, they'll always say, first and foremost, the Balfour Declaration. And it's interesting because Jews somehow parade the Balfour Declaration as a sort of accomplishment. I mean, who are the British to give us the land in the first place? Or the UN partition plan and the UN vote to acquire Israel, as if like that gives us legitimacy. Like what if in 1948 the United Nations said no? Would we have just picked up and left and said, oh, okay, we're just going to leave now? No, it's not the United Nations that gave us the right to live on this land and records in any way the moral standard of like what is legitimate or illegitimate. So why did the British write the Balfour Declaration in the early 1900s? They wrote the Balfour Declaration, which is really a paragraph on a piece of paper that says, we have the intention to create a Jewish state, written to Lord Balfour. But when they wrote this, they were not controlling the territory. So this is like a promise of if we are to take the land from the Ottomans, then we have the intention to do that. Okay, let's fast forward. They take over the land. Fast forward a little bit of time where they still are not doing what they've said. All of a sudden, the Nazis are a problem in Europe, and the Nazis are killing Jews and fighting the British. You would think that your enemy of your enemy is your ally, and you would think that you had already stated that you want to allow the Jews to come back. They were turning ships away from the British Mandate of Palestine back into the Holocaust, back into the gas chambers, back into the ovens to be killed. So why would you state that you have an intention to help Jews create a Jewish state, but yet Jews are fleeing for their lives from your same enemy, and yet you're doing everything to prevent Jews from coming back? And then even after the war, with the white papers of preventing Jews from coming in, of keeping them in detainment camps in Cyprus or in Mauritius, and doing everything that you can to not create a Jewish state, what we see in practice is that the British did everything but allow the Jews to create a state. And according to official British records, the reason for why the British left was due to Jewish terrorism. And if you look at interviews, and I've posted interviews of this before, of British police that served at that time in the British Mandate of Palestine, they will all tell you that the British were overall very pro-Arab and anti-Jewish. So then the question is, why create this documentation of a paragraph to say that this is what you want to do if this is not what you wanted to do and not what you did? Well, the same reason for why the Arab world will always source this as a document is the reason for why the British created this document. Because they wanted to give the experience of Zionism, of returning to Zion, of Jews coming back home purely just as that idea, as an extension of European colonialism. And if the British wrote a document saying that this is what they want to do, it must be that the British that are trying to push their colonial Western, view on the Middle East, and the Arabs are pushing back from that because they don't want that happening, then the idea of Jews returning back into this region is just an extension of them, and thus I'm against it. And that's how they convinced both sides to experience each other as enemies, which trickles down to several conflicts, several wars, and to where we are today. Now, thankfully, the British are no longer here, and this is not a shot at any individual who identifies as British. It's what your government did in the past. You know, it is what it is. We're moving forward from it. Let's talk about America. So many Jews I grew up in the US are like, oh yeah, we need America, we need America. Even Bibi Netanyahu writes in his book that there needs to be a superpower that Israel depends on, and that superpower is America. Well, America wasn't here for us in 48, wasn't here for us in 67. They did start coming after 67 because they realized that Israel is going to stay and it's going to be a strong country and maybe we can use it to influence it. But the way America controls the world, the way it's dominant over the world, is it finds regions that have conflicts. It aligns itself with the strongest power that will maintain the control and push their foreign policy. It makes those countries dependent on their supply of military goods, and then through that pushes their policy and does everything to prevent the solutions from happening. Because if you're running a race and Israel's a pretty fast runner, has a lot of potential, we're going to throw some banana peels in order to like make sure that Israel is going to stay back. And that's what's been happening. You know, they're giving weapons to all sides. The U.S. foreign aid is something that I've been vocally very much so against. The aid is not actual financial money that Israel can do what it wants. It's credit to buying weapons and military technology, but it comes with an exchange that we cannot sell weapons to any country without the approval of the United States. We cannot buy weapons or technology without the approval of the United States. So it puts us in a situation where we are completely dependent on the United States, and then allows them to dictate onto us what we do. And even we can look at the Lavi program, which was a program that Israel tried to create its own fighter jets. Why did America come in, swoop, and stop that program? Because it didn't want Israel to be dependent on its own jets, and wanted Israel to be dependent on the F-15s and 16s so that it can push its foreign policy. Why did Sharon take out the Jews in 2005 from Gaza, when Sharon was the one who allowed the Jews to come in there in the first place? Why? Because there was a pressure from the United States to pull out, knowing that it would create what it would create, in order to keep Israel and the Palestinians in this constant struggle to sell weapons on both sides, to seem as if they're the higher individuals, and to push policies that, you know, serve their interests. So I don't view America as our ally in the way that the government has acted towards us, making us dependent onto them. That doesn't mean America is our enemy. That doesn't mean I'm against having relationships with America. I want relationships with the world, but I don't want toxic relationships. And I don't want foreign involvement that prevent us from being who we are and that prevent us from moving forward for all peoples in this land.
How do we become financially dependent?
So if you need to depend, you need to first diversify. So we need to know that America in our lifetime might fall. I mean, we already see huge divisions happening within the society and things breaking apart. And, you know, no one thought that enlightenment would fall and would lead to the Nazi regime. No one thought that the Roman Empire would fall. No one thought that the Greek Empire. But eventually those empires fall. Eventually things change in history. And right before that was happening, the social fabric of the society was tearing itself apart from within. And that's what we see in happening in America. Plus there's Russia and China and India and many other players making moves to take on the dominance of the world. So it's not that crazy of a concept to think that America could fall. And if it does, what happens then? You know, or it's not that crazy to see America socially becoming more and more anti-Israel. We already see already the people who are anti the Jews have completely hijacked the left and the Democratic Party. You know, it's not that hard to eventually see the right becoming more extreme right, and the extreme of the right and the left both equally hate the Jews and Israel. What if America turns against Israel? You know, what do we do then? So if we need already to depend on weapons, just like in 1948, Israel wasn't necessarily developing its weapons right away. You didn't have Tavors and other things that it developed later. It was sourcing weapons and ammunition and things from different sources. You don't invest all of your eggs in the same basket. So if you need to depend already, in, let's say planes. Okay, we need planes now. Okay, get some planes from here. If someone cuts off your source of getting planes, you're already set other ways. That's on the short term. On the long term, we need to start developing our own infrastructure within Israel, which we do so in some ways, but in all ways for us to be solely dependent on ourselves, and then not to allow Israel to be selling weapons to countries that commit human rights violations, which happens. Happens because the US really wants to sell them weapons, and they do so indirectly by making Israel sell them those weapons, like South Sudan and other countries that Israel gives weapons to.
We sell them weapons?
Yes.
Why?
Even Nigeria. I was captured and taken into prison with an Israeli gun. They had Tavors onto them. Now, why do they sell weapons to those countries? Well, the only countries that Israel can sell weapons to are countries that the U.S. has approved of it. So this is the strategy of the U.S. to, instead of selling weapons to countries that commit massacres, we're going to get Israel to do it. It's still the same like funding. It's coming from the same source. So, you know, it's much more malicious than we think what's going on. And once we start realizing it, again, I'm not going to go and say I want no relationship with America. I want a relationship with America. I appreciate, you know, the concept of America. There's many criticisms to be had. I think there's value in this place. I think there's many amazing human beings. But I'm for creating healthy relations with other countries, not toxic relations with other countries.
As an independent country, yes. Not as a 51st state.
Yes, I mean... That statement to me, 51st day, is ridiculous. But yeah, completely independent from all. So that's what we do is in our hands. And hopefully with that power, we use that ability to make the world a better place.
Can I ask you about the Israeli government and what you think of them in this time period? Because I was here during the Hafganah for 2 months in Tel Aviv. I saw Palestinian flags every single day. Jews holding flags from the river to the sea. I was scared to tell people that I was a religious Jew in Tel Aviv because I got yelled at. My friends who are a same-sex couple were at Dizengoff, Kikar Dizengoff. They were spat at. They're not religious. What do we think? Obviously, the most important thing, as you said in the beginning, is Achdut. The reason why Beis HaMikdash was destroyed and the reason why we're in diaspora for 2,000 years was because we couldn't get along with each other. How do we, as an Israeli, I mean, now I can say that I'm from Israel too, because you gave me permission to do so. How do we get on the same page? How do we respect our government? How do we move forward?
When Israel was established, it didn't have the time to create a government that works for its peoples. What we currently have right now clearly doesn't work. The right thinks it's too much to the left thinks it's too much to the right, the religious thinks it's too secular, and the secular thinks it's too religious, let alone the fact that Palestinians also don't find their place within the structure that we have. So the system that we've built is basically a similar copy, not 100%, but to the British parliamentary system. And we changed the language to Hebrew and put on Magen Davids, but it's not a Jewish system at its core. And it's more so for homogeneous thought, like you have in Europe. When you have two Jews and at least three opinions, it's not a system that works. It's also a parliamentary system that at any moment, the different parties within a coalition can pull out their votes, breaking the coalition and forcing a new election at any moment. So it's not like you get elected and you have 4 years, and then you get elected and you have another 4 years, like in the United States. At any moment, you can have a new election in Israel. It's super super volatile. There's, and you have so many opinions in Israel that you have so many parties, right? You have 120 seats. To be able to have a party that takes over power, you have to have at least over half, which is half of 120 is 60, over half is minimum 61. But no one has 61. You have 20, you have 10, you have 2, you have 3. And so the larger parties in their 20s go to the party with 5 votes, with 2 votes, with 10 votes. They make deals with them. Oh, religious Jews, you don't want to do the army? Okay, give me your vote. So you want this position of Secretary of Minister of Interior? Okay, give me your votes and I give you that. And already by the time that the politician on whatever side, on the right or left, comes into power, he or she already has their hands tied behind their back. And it gives, let's say, the coalition is 62, okay, a very weak coalition. A party with 2 votes, which represents a very small minority of Israel, has the ability to go to the prime minister and say, if you don't do what we want, tomorrow you have a new election. And so you already create a structure within Israel that they think very short term, because all they care about is creating policies now, investing their time and energy in something that they can get a quick return, and then using that to then run in the next election. You know, like I talked to them about the tribes of Israel. I was like, nobody knows about that. Nobody cares. It's not going to give me votes. So no, but I can build a bridge and then go in the next campaign and say, look at all the good I've built for Israel. Or if there's a social issue that's popular, do things that are relating to that social issue in order to get votes. So they think very short term. On top of that, it's a very divisive system. You know, when you look at not the parties on the right and the left, but you look at the people who vote for the right or the people who vote for the left, why did they vote for the right? Because it's talking about security, identity, economy, health, and national connection to the land. All beautiful, core, important values. The people that are voting for the left, and you ask them, why are they voting for the left? Social justice, human beings' lives, values, minority rights, poverty, environment, all important as well. Who said those things contradict themselves? They don't. They're all important equally, and they need to be brought together. So it is not a structure that we have that takes ideas and brings them together. It is something that is built to be divisive and short-thinking. So I always say, don't hate the player or blame the player, but change the game. And so the political system that we have is not one built to work. And I don't think the solution will come by putting a different leader. I think that leaders are earned by how the people are. So people earn the leaders that they get. You don't change the leader and then get a different people. You change the people and then you get a different leader. And we see this in the Torah as well. You know, the first king of Am Yisrael is Melech Shaul. Great for the economy, great for the military, great for the infrastructure. But, you know, we experience him as not the best king because we wanted him for the wrong reasons. All nations had a king, so we want to be like all nations and we want to have a king. All nations have a country, we also want to have a country. Why? Because other nations have a country, we should have a country too. That's not the reason why we should have Israel. And that's why only when Am Yisrael was able to evolve and realize we don't want a king because everyone else has a king, that's not why we want. We want a king for that person to lead us, for us to fulfill what we're here on earth to do. And when we evolve as a nation to, we want Israel, not because all countries have a country, but because we want to have a country that is used as a vessel to achieve our purpose in this world, that brings in the values and ideas on the ideological tribes of the left, the right, the religious and secular together, and fulfills that mission. And I think once we ideologically shift to that, that's when we'll deserve the better leader. So Rav Kook talks about that, you know, the past, let's say, the foundation of Israel was like a Malchut Shaul. So we've been 75 years living under Malchut Shaul. The goal of our generation is to evolve and to deserve a Malchut David.
That's so interesting. Also, because the early Zionists, it's so ironic now because I was in Near Oz yesterday and obviously it's horrendous what was going on and spent a lot of time in their community and they're clearly very secular, clearly do not, like you can't even say, oh, that was a miracle. Like those are not the sort of vernacular and vocabulary that you can use in those communities, very secular. And one of the people of the community actually came up to the Shlucha and Eilat that I worked with and she said to her, I hated you more than the Palestinians. Like I had a hatred towards you pre-7th of October. And it's like right now Zionism has evolved so much. So, and Zionist today, it's like, what does it mean to be Zionist? Because I know that's a huge conversation, but the first Zionists had very different goals. They were very anti-God. They were very anti-religion. And Zionism has evolved today to be, it is Judaism. There's no differentiation. Without Judaism, why are we here? there's no Torah, why do we live on this land? So a lot of what you're saying sort of answers that question, that we really are step two of Zionism in that regard.
Yeah, I don't think all of the early founders of Zionism were anti-God. I think many of them were secular, and many of them didn't necessarily, you know, connect with the concept of God, because maybe it was taught to them in a way that didn't speak to their neshama, in a very restrictive way, that maybe caused a lot of secular Jews to then leave Judaism because of it. But Zionism is the idea to return back to Zion. We did that. 67, we came back to Jerusalem. Zionism is over. The question is, what's next? And I think that's the conversation we need to have. What is the next chapter of Jewish history? Now what? Generations fought to get us here. Now we need to know, where are we going towards next? And we've never even opened that for a dialogue within the society of like figuring out who we are. And that's why there's always, you know, waves of anti-Semitism, waves of wars that somehow brings us together. Like, anti-Semitism and war is plan B. We're on a path, we get off the path, we forget who we are, we forget why we're here, we start hating each other, fighting each other. A nation comes up, rises, does something horrible to the Jewish people, slaps us in the face. We wake up and realize, wait a minute, we're actually all one family. Wait a minute, when we say Shana Baba Yerushalayim, we should actually Shana Baba go to Yerushalayim. And then we do that, and then there's nothing that's like the next step, and we tend to forget, and we divide, and we go into our little groups, and then we start hitting each other, and then we get slapped again. So I think we need to find plan A. That's the goal. Plan B, we already know what it looks like. We know that there's no outcome where the Jewish people will be defeated. You know, we know that the end result, you know, we've already seen the ending of the movie that we're living in. We know that the ending is Mashiach. Like, there's no doubt that we're going to get there. The question is, which generation is going to do it? And plan B is not a way to get to Mashiach. It's only through plan A. And I think plan A is finding out what is the purpose of Am Yisrael, fulfilling that purpose, fixing this world, creating the equilibrium within the ecosystem that broke, and uniting all of us to the oneness and bring Shamayim Va'aretz. You know, how do we do that? Many different ideas, but we can't get to the destination if we don't start driving the vehicle that we're in, which is the state of Israel, the land of Israel, or even understanding that it's a vessel to begin with, to do something with it.
But now I want to know what we have to do to get there.
Again, it's like the mission statement is Tikkun Olam Ohel HaGoyim. All problems that exist in this world, we have to heal, and all nations that have their own role within the body that they exist within, right? We're all one. They have to fulfill their greatness and their potential, and we have to free them for them to achieve their potential, which is great and different in different ways to us. You know, I'll give you an example. In Yellowstone National Park, you had a situation where the wolves had been hunted out. And because there were no more wolves, the bison were overgrazing the lands because nothing was chasing them. There were no predators. And as they were overgrazing, they were eating the grass until the root. Because there was no more grass and life living on that dirt, the dirt started to dry up. And because of that, there were no more bugs. And when there were no more bugs, there were no more birds. And all of a sudden, just from removing the wolves, you see a collapse in the ecosystem. Scientists realize that. You know, because we're conscious today as beings. We're not just, you know, apes and caterpillars and fish that wouldn't be able to notice or do something about it. Scientists notice that as being conscious human beings that we are. Fix the problem, reintroduce wolves. The bison started to go from one plane to the next. The grass started to grow back. The bugs started to grow back. The birds started to grow back. And they fixed the situation. Now, on a more macro scale, there is many problems within our world ecosystem. There are many things disconnecting us, from idolatry to materialism, to hatred and jealousy, to poverty and starvation, to pollution. And Am Yisrael's role, individually and collectively, is to heal the world from that. If other nations choose to do it too, well, more power to us. The better, the more, the better. But in the meantime, this is what we chose. And once we actually fix this world and then empower others to fulfill their potential, we will see a time where this is fixed. How that will look like, I don't know. But I know that we will. And for me, Mashiach is not an individual. It's a achievement. And it's an achievement of a generation. And every generation can do it. We could have done it before. We can do it now. And if we don't do it now, we can do it after. The only question is, which generation will rise up and accomplish that. I think a lot of examples in the Torah, when we're talking about Malchut Shaul and Malchut David, we could look at it as a generational experience of a mindset within now recreated civilization. It's not necessarily of an individual that's Shaul or an individual that's David. And I think when we look at Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David, the two expressions of this idea, Mashiach ben Yosef is the physical recreation. By the way, this is Rav Kook, if anyone wants to look into it. The physical recreation of Israel, which we've already done. And Mashiach ben David is the ideological recreation of Israel, which is the next stage that we're on of moving Jewish history forward on.
Wow. So Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Beit HaMikdash can coexist.
Well, Al-Aqsa Mosque is the gray, brownish mosque next to the Golden Dome,
yeah.
Which the Golden Dome wasn't golden until the church built a golden church in front of it. And in order to be more shiny, they made it gold. And it used to be Beit al-Maqdisi, which means Beit HaMikdash in Arabic. And it was a monument to show that this is where the Beit HaMikdash is. So if that's the reason you built that, it's to preserve that this is where the Beit HaMikdash is, then let's build the Beit HaMikdash. How we're going to build it, if it's a different structure, if it's the same structure, if it's added on, if even the original site of the Beit HaMikdash is actually there, or even a place next to it. There's some archaeologists that believe it's not even there, so it wouldn't even conflate to build something else next to it. Those are details that could be found. But that's a later step from where we are.
You spent a lot of time researching ethnicity, am I correct?
Yeah, I mean, ethnic groups are groups that have similar backgrounds. I wouldn't necessarily call the Jewish people an ethnicity. I would say like maybe Semites or Middle Easterners are an ethnicity. You know, just like you can have someone that's Hispanic. What's the Hispanic ethnicity? It's the fact that you have a similar language and a similar experience from a region. So I would say that we are an ancient, native, indigenous civilization, and we have a beautiful gift to the world that the world has yet to see.
What do you think about the pro-Palestinian? Obviously, I spent a lot of time digging on the other side. What do you think about all the DNA testing, 100% European, Ashkenazi Jew? A lot of that thinking about like Bibi Netanyahu, Shimon Peres, was Shimon Peresky, a lot of that thinking that we are, it's been 2,000 years, we're not from here, we have a different DNA testing. How do we stand up and resolve that?
So when you find Ashkenazi Jewish European DNA, it is not European DNA, it is Middle Eastern DNA found in Europe.
Okay.
So it doesn't mean it's white people's DNA or any way similar to other Europeans. It is found right now in Europe because Ashkenazi Jews have been displaced and living amongst Europeans for so long. So that's where it's currently located and found, but that doesn't mean that's where it originates from. When you look at Jewish DNA, it's Semitic, it's from the Middle East, and this is the land. And you can look at Kohens that are Ashkenazi, Sfaradi, Mizrahi, even Kohens, a part of the Buba and the Lemba in Zimbabwe and South Africa, who have the same markers of descending from the same male ancestor from the same region. So you know, we descend from this land. Palestinians, 30 to 60% of Palestinians have Jewish DNA. If you go to places like Yafo, Akko, Safed, what we call Tzfat, Shrem, what they call Nablus, Jerusalem, Hebron, Nazareth, Bethlehem, all places that were ancient Jewish cities, the Jews didn't disappear. The Jews were forcibly converted to Christianity and Islam. Almost all Christian Palestinians are originally Jews that converted to Christianity. And in those places that I just listed, 90% of the Palestinians there that are identifying as Palestinian, most of them Muslim, are descendants of Jews. I just went to your university, you know, a few days ago, and I was there speaking to a Palestinian, and he said, you know, I asked him, where's your family from? And he said, oh, they're from Yafo. I was like, oh, so your ancestors are Jews. And he smiled at me and said, they are.
Well,
and they know it. So genetically, it is proven Palestinians know this way more than Jews know it. So, you know, in terms of their DNA and why they're connected to this land and why they're so willing to fight and even sometimes die for this land, it makes sense because they're really connected from here. You know, that some of them may be praying towards Mecca, but their heart is facing Jerusalem. That is real. That's something to unite on. That's not something to divide on. That's something to appreciate and to bring together. So although they are the post-colonial identity, it was an identity created post the colonization of Judea, right? The Romans renamed the land to Palestine, and then this identity is born in the years following. Even 500 years after the land was called Palestine, Islam wasn't yet born, and only later after its birth does Islam eventually travel through Arab colonization into the land. But nonetheless, they have a valid connection to this land, and we shouldn't be using our our connections to compete. When I see a Palestinian with what I call the map of Israel and they call the map of Palestine, I don't look at that like, oh, you're taking something away from me. I look at it as like, we're connected to the same place and we have the same mission in this land. That's something we unite on.
Okay, I'm going to do that because I was busy thinking like they're trying to take our lands away from us, from the river to the sea. There is this, I mean, I can say that just having this conversation with you, I actually feel like my eyes have been opened a little bit. No, we do think that they're trying, every time I see them wearing that necklace with the Palestinian sign on it, I'm like, they want to take away our land from us, like this is our land.
There might be people who have that mentality. It doesn't mean that you don't have individuals who currently in their mindset from how they were raised think that you need to go, right, that they exist. But the fact that they connect to this land is not what's getting them to that conclusion. It's their experience negatively with Israel and their brainwash that they've gone through. So on the basis of them connecting to this land, that could be a form of unity and something we unite on. You know, I have three younger brothers, okay? One of my brothers left Columbia University to go fight back in war and was also in Gaza. So my mom had two children in Gaza.
Wow.
Let's say I'm wearing a necklace with the map of Israel and it says my Hebrew name, Israel. And my brother Mikael wears a necklace and he has his Hebrew name Shimon, all right? The fact that he has Shimon and I have Israel, am I gonna experience that he has a different name on the necklace as you're taking away from me? No, that's your name, that's my name, and we both are connected to this land, this is the same. So they have their own symbols and their own names, understandably, because there was no space to exist within Israel. Like they can't identify as Israeli if they're living in the West Bank, Judea and Samaria, if they're living in Jordan, if they're living within the diaspora, if they're living in Gaza, there's no space for them to identify as Israeli. So what other name are they going to identify with if not Palestinian, which the land was called Palestine for 2,000 years? It's a real experience. You know, it's really like even Jews called the land Palestine at that time. It's not like it's a made up thing. So obviously they're going to identify with that. And if they do in the future or not, it's up to them. You can or you can't, it doesn't really matter to me. As long as you respect that for me, it's Israel. This is what I need. And I respect using my ability to then create what you need. And we're able to respect and live together. I've had many experiences where I meet Palestinians with like a necklace and they have the Palestinian flag. And, you know, I'd go up to them and say, oh, where are you from? And say, oh, I'm from Palestine. I was like, oh, we're from the same land. He's like, oh, you're Palestinian too? I was like, well, very similar people, but I'm a Jew. I'm Israeli. I'm like, oh, that's messed up. Why were you coming? I was like, what's messed up? I'm coming with you with love. Like, you're my cousin. You know, we both belong to this land. And all of a sudden, they're like, wait a minute. Your love for the land doesn't take away from my love for the land. And you appreciate my love for the land. And you want to, like, connect with me for that and show me human experience. And many times it ends up in us being like, you know, tears in our eyes and then just hugging each other and realizing we don't have to be like this. We don't have to be like this. We don't have to be in this situation. War comes when we've failed to correct what we're in. I work every single day when we're not at war and even when at war to prevent us going into war. So what war represents is the success of those who want to see this land divided and the failures of there wasn't enough done or enough people doing work to heal this situation and to bring us together. So at some point the smoke will settle from this war, and I only hope that all of us, Jews and Palestinians, Arabs, Muslims, Israelis, all of us connected to this land, we invest our energy in building a future for our children and not maintaining the past that we've inherited from our parents and grandparents.
Wow. But yesterday I saw this home of in near Oz, this he was a very left-wing, pro-Palestinian Israeli that would go every single Friday pick up Gazans from Gaza and drive them to the hospitals in Israel. And they literally did the most horrendous things to him. Do you think this is a realistic future? Like, how soon do you think we could create that reality?
How soon can we have Mashiach?
Now.
So that's your answer. Again, it's about changing the dynamics. A lot of people will say, well, they're Israeli Arabs, some of which identify as Palestinian, some of which don't, who are living in Israel, and some of them turn against Israel and reject Israel as citizens, and they have good lives and they have equal rights. So how could we trust them if when they get equal rights, they still don't accept it? Well, if you're living in Australia and you're living in Sydney, and the Jews in Sydney have full equal rights and are respected in Sydney, but the Jews living in Perth and in Melbourne don't, even as a Jew in Sydney with a good life, you wouldn't be okay with Australia. So Palestinians who are living in Israel proper today, who have equal rights, and that's great, they should keep it, cannot all of them be okay if Palestinians in the diaspora and in Gaza and in Judea and Samaria are also not benefiting from that reality.
Do you think it's our fault?
I don't think it's our fault. I think it's our responsibility to fix it. We didn't create it, we have a responsibility to fix it. If the body becomes sick, it is not the immune system that creates the sickness, but it's the immune system's responsibility to heal the body.
That's really...
Let's say someone wants to attack your child one day. You didn't create that reality, but you have a responsibility to prevent it, right? Because you'd be the mother, that's your responsibility. And if you know there's something that's gonna happen and you choose to do nothing about it, and that something happens, you didn't create it, you didn't do it, but you failed your responsibility to prevent it. When you are someone in power, when you choose to be a mother, when you choose to be the immune system, when you choose to be the nation to fix this world, when you don't do your job, there are consequences.
So we need to do more to improve the lives of the Palestinians.
100%. 100%.
Wow. Okay, and my final question is, what do you think is the message for the Jewish people in the world right now? What is the most important thing that every single Jewish person in the world needs to hold on to through the anti-Semitism, through everything we've experienced, through the collective trauma of the past 152 days? What can we do to keep our spirits high and to move forward?
First of all, say Toda Hashem for all the beautiful things that we have. That we're living in a beautiful time period where we have our home. A lot of Jews are affluent and successful, and even we should be thankful for being able to see, being able to walk, being able to hear, being able to taste. A lot of people who lose their vision would give everything back to be able to see again, would give everything back to be able to walk if you lose your access to your legs, and we have all those things. So first of all, Toda for all the amazing things that we have. Second of all, we're living in a very beautiful time in Jewish history where we're now starting to evolve from just having a vessel to understanding that why we have that vessel and using it for something. So that is the way our generation should shift, is what is the next chapter of Jewish history. I think we're also on a cusp of seeing millions upon millions of the tribes of Israel returning, which will also shift a lot of things within Israel, even culturally, even with ideologically of how we see things, and that we need to understand the formulas of the world. When the Jews are united, empowered and fulfilling our mission, we overcome all struggles. When the Jews are divided, assimilating and forgetting who we are, we will see the rise of anti-Semitism. So already understand that as a struggle. Understand that the reason why anti-Semitism exists is it's a rejection to the Jewish people's failing their purpose. The reason why the far right blames us for being the left, and the far left blames us for being the right, and the communist blames us for capitalism, and the capitalist blames us for communism, and the white supremacists see us as enemy number one, and the black supremacist, the Farrakhan, sees us as enemy number one. There's a phenomenon that's happening that all extremist groups in this world come to the same conclusion. How? Differently, but that they come to the same conclusion, and that the Jew is the source of the problem. Me and you, no, we're not. We didn't create the Black Plague. We didn't create economic strife in Spain leading to the Inquisition, in Germany leading to the Holocaust. We didn't create COVID. We don't run the medias. We don't do these things. So why are the people who have the most pain of the suffering this world has, who then become the biggest extremists, come to some sort of conclusion that we are the source of that? And it's because something deep down in their neshama, most of the time, subconsciously, tells them that it's our fault. And it's not our fault because we created it, but it's our responsibility to correct it. And once we start understanding that, then we can start moving in the right way. I would also recommend every single Jew to be extra focused on the problems that they see, because each of us sees different problems on the micro level to the macro level of what we can do, of what we find problematic. And the reason you see problems is because your eyes are communicating to you of what your neshama wants you to do. You fix the problems that you see. If you see a problem somewhere, you go and you fix it, and you use the abilities you have, and you work on yourself to gain more abilities to go and to correct the problems that you see. And if I think everyone is driven by fixing those problems, then they'll be way more fulfilled and, you know, being on the path of doing their tikkun, which is why they're here in the first place.
And that's how we can eliminate anti-Semitism.
When the Jews fulfill their purpose in healing the world and empowering all nations and know who they are and aren't divided, there will be no anti-Semitism.
Wow. So Rudy, I think you should be the president.
I don't know that. I think the system is built for it to be corrupt. And if I go into the system, I naturally won't be able to do what I got to do. So my goal is not to move myself forward, but to move Am Yisrael forward. And I think I'm doing that in the best way that I can right now. And definitely not getting involved with politics.
Hashem should bless you that you should continue your shlichut, really impacting people's lives. You're an educator. You're educating the world. And we're lucky to have you in it. Thank you so much for everything.
Toda rabah.